Куда? Кандидаты?
Алексей Анатольевич является зарегистрированным кандидатом в мэр города Москвы. Чего это держали незаконно?
The Moscow police this week unwittingly provided Alexei Navalny with a picture-perfect kickoff for his long-shot campaign to become mayor of the Russian capital. The anti-corruption blogger and opposition leader was speaking to supporters and journalists outside the Moscow Electoral Commission, where he had just turned in the necessary papers to register as a candidate, when he was inexplicably seized by police officers and hauled into a waiting paddy wagon. What happened next was nothing short of remarkable. Chanting shame on you and Navalny as our mayor, hundreds of his supporters surrounded the vehicle and demanded Navalny be released. And after a brief standoff, the police relented and released Navalny and apologized to him.
This is the beginning of our spectacular election campaign. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for staying here and not leaving me alone in this. And it had the right effect. They let me go. Let's do the same for everyone. One for all, and all for one.
A killer campaign ad? Perhaps. But the whole incident also illustrates the Kremlin's dilemma in dealing with the charismatic and wily Navalny. Next week, on July 18th, a court in Kirov is due to render a verdict in Navalny's highly politicized trial on embezzlement charges that are widely seen as trumped up. A guilty verdict could land the Kremlin's fiercest foe in prison for 6 years, end his mayoral campaign, and finally get him out of the regime's hair. Or will it? Would Navalny be even more dangerous to the Kremlin in prison than on the street? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, guys.
And also with me in the studio in Prague is special guest and veteran Kremlin watcher David Satter, a longtime Moscow correspondent, a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and author of numerous books on Russia, including most recently, It Was a Long Time Ago and It Never Happened Anyway. Welcome aboard, David. It's great to finally have you on the podcast.
Great to be here.
In his closing statement at his trial last week, Navalny, despite the likelihood of a long prison sentence, came across like a man who knows he owns the future. To get the ball rolling here, let's listen to some of the highlights and let's get you guys to react to them.
Let us get out of the world of fantasies and fairy tales. If anyone thinks that myself or my colleagues will cease our activity because of this trial, or the Bolotnaya trials, or the many other trials going on all around the country, they are gravely mistaken. Some may think that this is not the best place for me to put forward conditions, to make threats, or plans for the future. I don't agree. I think this is the best place to speak about my plans, to make threats, and to set conditions. And I state now that my colleagues and I will do everything possible to destroy this feudal regime being established in Russia.
David, you covered the dissidents back in the 70s and have a bit of perspective here. So let's start with you. We have a man facing 6 years in prison, and he's standing there threatening to liquidate this feudal regime. Is this a man who might be even more dangerous to the Kremlin inside prison than out?
It's certainly possible. We've seen before that the Russian public sympathizes with those who are seen to be victims of persecution. Navalny is sufficiently forthright in his criticisms and even aggressive in his attitude that he may be, in certain respects, less of an object of sympathy than perhaps others. But nonetheless, insofar as he's seen to be mistreated, I think that his reputation and his authority will grow.
Let's listen to another clip from Navalny's closing statement, which I found nothing short of stirring.
Despite the fact that I am in the dock, my colleagues and I will defend you from this. You, people living in Kumyony, Amutninsk, Kirov, Vladivostok, and all other places. If somebody thinks that having heard the threat of 6-year imprisonment, I would run away abroad or hide somewhere, they are mistaken. I cannot run away from myself. I have nothing else but this, and I don't want to do anything else but to help my country, to work for my compatriots.
Mark, a bit back in the podcast, you and I discussed how effective Navalny, we were wondering how effective Navalny would be in using his trial to get his message out, simply turning this show trial on its head and turning it into his show. It seems he, to me at least, it seems he didn't disappoint, no?
Well, certainly this is vintage Navalny, a very fine blend of nationalism, idealism, and radicalism. Perhaps a nice little sort of sidewise jab at Guriev and the others who...
Guriev, who is writing his economic platform.
Indeed, but nonetheless, the people who are happy to, quote, run away abroad. And so it's a very effective package. And I think it's also interesting that we saw in the previous one that I think we have one of his new buzzwords that's coming up to the fore, the feudal regime. That's coming up much more now. The question, obviously, though, remains how far he can get beyond speaking to his existing constituency. He clearly can play a whole variety of public roles very, very effectively indeed. He has to get people to, A, want to listen to him, and B, be able to listen to him. If he can do that, I think he can leverage this kind of performance quite effectively.
Okay. All right, and let's listen to the third and final clip from Navalny's remarkable closing statement.
I think that none of us has the right to neutrality. None of us has the right to evade the work aimed at making our world better. We do not have this right, because every time someone thinks, why don't I step aside and wait? He only helps this disgusting feudal regime, which, like a spider, is sitting in the Kremlin.
Sounds like a call to arms, almost. David, let's assume for a minute that Navalny gets a stiff sentence next week. What does he have to do while incarcerated to remain effective?
That's a difficult question. I think that he has to continue to maintain contact with his followers. He has to be unflinching in his opposition. And, of course, events have to play in his favor to a certain extent. I think there's a very high likelihood that that will happen because the regime that exists now in Russia will have a tendency to degenerate. It will not become less corrupt, less authoritarian, less brutal. And Navalny will be a living symbol of resistance as long as he's behind bars.
And he's got an organization that's vowing to continue his work. He's not standing by himself. He's got Rospil and his whole little blogging operation. It's not a little blogging operation. It's quite a blogging operation and a lot of followers. My last count, almost 7,000 people have signed up onto a special Facebook page that was launched to go out onto Manej Square after the verdict's read to, quote unquote, discuss the verdict. The Moscow authorities said this is unsanctioned and they will take appropriate measures. Navalny supporters are responding. Navalny stepped on the side on this. I'm sure he's got his hands in it, but it's his supporters said, you know, Article 31 of the Russian Constitution protects our right to peacefully assemble, and we're just going to go out and talk. So they're not going to have any, big podium or microphone or placards or signs or anything. But this is going to put the authorities, Mark, what do you think, in a pretty difficult position, rounding up people that are out, maybe walking their dogs on Manej Square on next Thursday. What do you think?
Yes, ridicule is often one of the best weapons you can use against a regime like this. Make it do things that make it look stupid, make it look petty, make it look spiteful. And therefore, in the circumstances, I think is a very effective tool. But again, we've got to realize that this is still a few thousand people possibly meeting in one place who may be ignored. They may be cracked down on. Again, if the authorities have any wits about them, they'll just ignore it. Let it happen. But
somehow
let's face
I don't
it,
think that's going
to
happen.
Yeah, on the whole, subtlety and discretion and elegance of an operation doesn't really seem to apply. But what we still come back to, again, to go back to this question about, well, let's say the authorities do put Navalny in prison. And suddenly, if I was a dark chancellor in the Kremlin and they'd ask me what to do, that's what I'd do. I'd be wanting to find ways of putting Navalny in prison, because he's dangerous in prison, but I think he's less dangerous than he is out.
This is that connection, yeah.
But nonetheless, if he does, I absolutely agree with David that he can put himself in a position that he can benefit as and when events play in his favour, as and when things go badly for the Kremlin. But it still, I think, locks him into a relatively passive position. He has to wait for the Kremlin to self-destruct, which it probably will do. But nonetheless, he will therefore only be capitalising on their failings.
You said, you pointed, and I'm not sure I know the answer to this question, if he's more dangerous in prison or on the street. What I see, though, in the way when I, as I was prepping for this podcast, and I touched on this in a couple of blogs I wrote this week, there's a bit of a paradox that the Kremlin has in dealing with Navalny right now, and they've really backed themselves into a corner here. Letting him off creates a hero. I mean, letting him off, even with a conditional sentence, I think, creates it. He's gonna walk, and he's gonna come out a hero, and he's gonna be stronger on the street. Putting him in prison creates a martyr, and so they've really boxed themselves into a corner here. I for one am very curious to see what they're gonna do here, and I'm not sure what they're gonna do here. I really do not have any idea. David, what do you think of this paradox? Which is better for the Kremlin, really? If you were a dark lord of the Kremlin, as Mark just put it.
It's hard to put myself in that position.
As hard as that may be for you to imagine yourself being, as respectable a man as you are. But if you imagine you are Volodin, you know, what do you advise Putin to do here?
I would put it a different way. I think that if you'll allow me, I just what would be the strategic thing to do?
I'll phrase that. I don't want to put you in a position that where you'd find distasteful. So
I think that my guess as to what will happen. So I may be proved wrong shortly, but I'm going to take a chance. And my guess is that they will give him the lightest possible punishment that they can give him that is capable of, to some degree, incapacitating him.
And what is that?
Well, for example, giving him a conditional sentence that would make it impossible for him to run for office, or sentencing him to 6 months or a year. Mm-hmm. Something that will take him off the street but will deny him the aura of martyrdom. Mm-hmm. That's my guess. Now, of course, don't hold me to it.
Yeah, and as Mark put out, subtlety is not actually the watchword of this.
I think
this,
that these calculations depend a lot on how the Kremlin perceives its present position, what they think they can get away with, how endangered they feel, and that's difficult for us on the outside to have a clear sense of that. We know that we know the way the trend is going, and we can well imagine that they don't feel as secure as they once did. But to what degree?
Right. And there's also, and this, I've been doing a little thinking about this the last few days. I mean, Navalny's been acting pretty damn confident for somebody who's facing a prison term, and there's also been a lot of rumblings in the press that Sobyanin, the current Moscow acting mayor, and by extension, of course, the Kremlin, wants Navalny in this race because it will bolster Sobyanin's credibility if he can beat Navalny head to head, right? And there's been a lot of, I saw a piece in Today in Izvestia that suggested this. There's also been suggestions in the press that even if he's convicted, he can still stay a candidate until all his appeals are exhausted, which could take quite a long time, right? So there's a lot of different balls in the air right now. But let's just say they let him, we looked at variant A, they put him in prison. Variant B, they let him run, and they can beat him. Let's face it. I mean, they can beat him in this mayoral election. Would that end the Navalny phenomenon? Mark?
Not at all. And this is why I'm a proponent of putting him in prison. When I have that particular head on, I should stress.
When you have that particular head on.
Quite. No, I mean, I think the point is, if he's let off, you said he's sort of turned into a hero. Well, he's turned into a hero to the people who already know him. and already believe that he's an innocent who's being unfairly attacked.
Which is 57% of Muscovites, according to
recent Levada poll. It's Muscovites, but not necessarily Russians.
It's 44%. It's a healthy plurality. Only 23% Russia-wide, according to the latest Levada poll, think he's guilty.
Sure. But the point is, what happens now? Again, I think the thing is, he becomes a hero for now. How long does that last? I think, again, the question is how it then gets managed. I mean, it's interesting what you say about Sobyanin actually wanting an election. Absolutely. This would turn him into, for the first time, a credible figure rather than just a functional technocrat. Right. And clearly, if Sobyanin, as I suspect, does have higher political aspirations, mm-hmm. this is what he needs to basically make himself a figure. What's good for Sobyanin is not necessarily good for the Kremlin, though, because precisely that campaign hands Navalny the one thing he has lacked so far, which is actually the means to be able to reach out to wider constituencies. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think at that point, that I think is the first time, really, that the Kremlin would lose the initiative. It might sound bizarre to say that up to this point, the Kremlin's had the initiative. And Navalny has played a weak hand phenomenally well at every point. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, what he has done is he has benefited from the blunders of the Kremlin, and realizing the sort of the emerging new politics that is beginning to grip Russia. At that point, I think Navalny has the opportunity to seize the initiative and do the key thing that he's needed to do, which is precisely to machine his politics, mm-hmm. to actually turn collections of enthusiasts, people who sort of follow him on Facebook and support his Rospil site and so forth, but to begin to actually turn that into a political machine. And that's when he becomes truly dangerous.
Because I've been wondering if this might not be where they're going. In a recent interview, Volodin said that it would be good to have Navalny in the election. Today, Izvestia was suggesting that this might be happening. Izvestia is not just a Kremlin mouthpiece, it's practically a Putin mouthpiece. One and the same, but not really. The Kremlin has many towers. But when I read something floated in Izvestia, I take it not seriously as the truth, but as what the Kremlin wants people to believe at any given time. And the question is, what does the Kremlin want people to believe this? David, what do you think? Could he be dangerous in this? I mean, I'm assuming he can't win, given the administrative resources at the Moscow mayor's office disposal. I'm assuming he can't win. What does he have to do to win by losing, if provided he runs?
Well, he has to make a credible showing. And
Hard to say.
I would have thought that he would have to get somewhere around 40%, 35-40%, he'd have to show that he can, even though the deck is stacked, that he can nonetheless attract a lot of support. The danger is that, for him, I mean, and to a degree for his followers, is that the Russian population has a deep distrust of political figures. And if he becomes a political figure, that attitude will inevitably affect him, and it will make it actually easier for the Kremlin and for those allied with the Kremlin to make people believe that he's really no different from anyone else. Mm-hmm. And yet it's by being different from everyone else that he has a chance to pose a real alternative to the system that exists.
Well, it's interesting you raise that, because I was waiting for the opportunity to bring this into the discussion. Both of you probably know, prior to this podcast earlier today, there was a pretty interesting exchange Mark and I were both involved in on Twitter about whether it is derisive to refer to Navalny as a blogger. I, of course, being a blogger myself, think that it's not. But actually, and I understand that the Russian media, the state media, the pro-Kremlin media does this derisively. He's just a blogger. But in my opinion, I think this increases his street cred as just a regular dude who wants to clean things up. And I think it actually helps him. If he becomes a politician, you're saying it might take away from this. But let's address this blogger issue. He is much more than a blogger. He's an attorney, first of all. He's now an opposition leader.
An attorney who blogs.
But he made his name. I mean, he got on my radar from his blogging, Because he wasn't just some, you know, dude in his pajamas, you know, putting his latest musings online. He was investigating corruption at Rosneft and at VTB and posting the documents to prove what he was doing on. So this isn't just a blogger. I refer to him as an anti-corruption blogger. But let's address this, because it is something the Russian media tries to deride him as just a blogger. I think it increases his street cred. Mark went back and forth on Twitter on this a bit, but let's do it for the benefit of the broader audience.
Sure, I have nothing against blogging, given that I blog myself. My view is actually it's more about the Western press, is when looking for the shorthand to describe Navalny, they still, in many cases, reach for blogger, which I think just misses the point of the phenomenon of Navalny. Because even if we look at his blogging precisely, just going back to what you're saying, actually, he was an investigative journalist who just happened to not have a media outlet in the conventional sense. And again, I think this speaks to the extent, going back to this point about Navalny, as someone who is understanding how the world is changing.
Exactly.
And even Russia is part of the world, whether it likes it or not. the world of social media, the world, frankly, of a middle class, all these various things. So I think the thing about Navalny is precisely that. And let me just sort of loop this in to David's point about the danger of becoming a politician. Is in some ways, Navalny has to triangulate himself between the independent blogger and just citizen activist, which is fine, but nonetheless, you know, he needs to become more than that. The politician who, perhaps in the name of building coalitions and consensuses, might be forced into making concessions, which is very, very dangerous, because that's the point where he starts being regarded as just one more of these opportunists. And the moral leader, the person who actually stands for something that is greater, that is not just a political platform, but actually sort of is about some central human facet that needs to be emphasized. Now, anyway, Navalny at the moment is speaking to all three of those. His challenge will be to continue speaking to all three of those and not just simply getting sort of pigeonholed as one of the three. Because definitely, just to sort of pick up finally on this point about political leader, the thing that really struck me from the last of those three clips that you played, when you were talking about, you know, no one has the right to neutrality,
yeah.
I think he has identified that actually the biggest challenge is not Bastrykin and his goons. It's not the Amon and their rubber truncheons. It's not even corruption and administrative resources. Actually, it's apathy. It's a belief amongst the Russian people that nothing can change and no one can change it. That is actually what is going to stop reform more than anything else.
Mm-hmm. David, your thoughts?
I have a difficult time seeing Navalny as a moral leader. The reason for this is not because I'm in any way against what he does in his anti-corruption work, all of which I think is very valuable, but rather because corruption is itself a symptom, and it's a symptom of a deeper ill, which is the moral state of Russian society, which Navalny does not address. And to the extent that he touches on genuinely moral issues, his positions are rather ambiguous. For example, he has positioned himself as a nationalist or a moderate nationalist in a multinational country in which such a position really doesn't make sense. The real challenge, I think, for an opposition leader, and I think this is one of the things that is going to be a long-range a problem for Navalny or anyone else who attempts to fill that niche, is that the anti-corruption card has been used before. After all, it was Yeltsin who campaigned against the corruption of Gorbachev. Gorbachev campaigned against the corruption of the party apparatus. Yeltsin against Gorbachev.
Putin against Yeltsin.
Now Navalny against Putin, insofar as he's campaigning on that issue. And in every case, the anti-corruption campaigners have proved to be more corrupt than the people they replaced. And that's because the moral base of the society didn't change. And my question always when I hear Navalny and others is, to what extent are they aware of Russia's fundamental moral problem? you know, the lack of respect for the individual, the lawlessness of the society, the idolization of the state, all of these things, all of these very fundamental problems, which Andrei Sakharov, for example, did address, but which are ignored in the amid the very well documented and certainly deserved and important charges of corruption. He said, for example, we have Navalny's statement that no one has the right to be neutral. Well, why? Why is that? Is there a fundamental moral issue at stake here, or is it just one group grabbing the resources of the country instead of a different group? Under those circumstances, we could well understand why people might remain neutral and just not
given the past. But I would say it's interesting that you raise Yeltsin, because Navalny right now reminds me of Yeltsin in 87, 88, 89.
Very much so.
But the difference, and he reminds me of that because he is tapping into something. And he is, like Yeltsin at that time, more in tune with where the society is at than the Kremlin. But one key difference is Navalny's coming completely from the outside. Yeltsin was a creature of the system, campaigning against the corruption of the previous creature of the system, who was campaigning against the corruption of the previous campaigner of the system. Navalny is really from the outside of all this. He really is from the outside of all this. He's also generationally, this is one of the first kind of political figures we've seen that truly came of age, not born, but came of age politically after the Soviet period. So we're seeing it's a little bit of a different animal, but it's I don't want to say Yeltsin 2.0 because that's the most ridiculously overused metaphor, you know, thing to say, but it's almost like that, but in a different context. But Mark, Dave was responding to your basic on a moral leader, and Navalny is a moral leader. I'd like to hear your thoughts on.
Well,
on that.
First of all, it's worth mentioning that maybe because I happen to have a visceral dislike of Boris Yeltsin, I'm particularly uncomfortable with the Yeltsin 2.0. But particularly, exactly, I think for Yeltsin, it was clear that anti-corruption was the weapon. This is a man who'd risen up through the party system. He was a sort of heavy-handed, local party boss in Yekaterinburg, Sverdlovsk, as was, and so forth. Suddenly he discovered this. I mean, he was on the cleaner end of the party boss spectrum, but that's not a particularly exalted place to be. Whereas Navalny, I think for him, yes, he's not Václav Havel. He's not a philosopher king. But I think
they might turn him into one if they put him in prison.
Yeah. But again, I think they are creating myths rather than the reality. But I think what is the case is that for him, corruption is not just simply his lever, his way of actually doing damage to the Kremlin and the elite and levering it open enough for him to be able to insert himself. I think for him, corruption is not just a symptom of the wider moral ills of Russia, but actually symbol of so much that is wrong. It is about the fact that those in power have impunity. It is about the fact that no one believes in law, in state, in duty, in responsibility, in mutuality, and all these kinds of things. Now, okay, there are, of course, distinct problems within Navalny's thinking. I mean, I'm not saying that he is a moral leader. I'm just saying that to be effective, he has to position himself as one. He has to simply say, I'm not just a politician. I'm standing for something that is wider than just this bunch of crooks and scoundrels rather than that one.
Mm-hmm. This is something I wanted to get to before we move on to the second. And we're going to talk about the general corruption of the system in the second half a bit. The inevitable comparison and contrast with Hodorkovsky has to come up. Here's somebody in Hodorkovsky who was an oligarch of the Yeltsin system who was turned into something of a martyr / moral leader, if you will, in prison. Where Navalny is starting from a different position than Hodorkovsky did. Because Hodorkovsky, people were against what the oligarchs were doing, and there was very little outcry when Hodorkovsky was there was outcry, but there was more ambiguity, is the way I guess I would put it, with the Hodorkovsky case, at least initially. Navalny, we're talking about. I mean, let's face it. I followed this trial. They showed me nothing to convince me that there's anything to these charges. How does the experience of what went on with Hodorkovsky and what might go on with Navalny in prison, how do these two things compare? Do either of you have any thoughts on that issue?
In terms of the reaction of society?
In terms of the reaction of society, yeah. In terms of how the effect of how it might play out, yeah.
The thing in the case of Khodorkovsky, and I wonder if Mark agrees, is that people witnessed how the oligarchs made their money. It's only we in the West who are unaware all too often of just how slimy, unethical, and criminal it really was. And we're also unaware of the extent to which the Russian population suffered and the millions of people really who suffered under those conditions.
Those of us that lived in Russia in the 90s.
Yeah, while a small number of corrupt persons became fantastically rich. So Khodorkovsky has behaved with considerable dignity in prison, and he is certainly a victim of selective justice, but it was almost predetermined that he would not be a figure of enormous a sympathy for the vast majority of Russians, just on the basis of their own experience. Case of Navalny, I think he has a much better shot at it. I think we can compare him actually with Yeltsin, because in 1987 Yeltsin made an independent speech in the Politburo, yeah, and he was forced out of office and humiliated. What people often forget is that Yeltsin begged Gorbachev, yeah, for forgiveness, but the Russian public forgot that as well. And when Yeltsin reemerged as a political figure, he enjoyed the sympathy of someone who had fought for the people and been mistreated. And I think that is a syndrome that we may see replayed in the case of Navalny if, in fact, he does get a stiff sentence or is punished in a way that people feel is draconian. The real problem, I think, is that, like Yeltsin, Navalny strikes me in any case as a morally superficial person. Mm. He has certainly said quite a lot about the corruption. But even in saying that we don't have the right to remain neutral, his inability to express why we don't have a right to remain neutral or to draw broader conclusions about the sources of Russian corruption make me, frankly, a little bit suspicious, if that's the right word, or a little bit doubtful about the true direction in which, were he in power, he would lead the country.
Well, I think if he ever gets power, I think we'll have the answer to that. And until we do, I would definitely reserve judgment on that.
Oh, of course, and I agree with that. But we do see the example of Yeltsin. I mean, Yeltsin was a popular hero, and yet once in power, he presided over the pillaging of the country. He himself was massively corrupt. He showed no concern for the welfare or lives of ordinary citizens, the very people who theoretically he was defending in the days when he was demonstratively riding public transport and showing how he didn't like privileges, before, of course, grabbing them himself.
Right. Mark, your thoughts on the Khodorkovsky-Navalny comparison and contrast?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. We've talked about Khodorkovsky in previous podcast, and it's not that he was innocent. One can say that he was more innocent than many others who never went to prison. And sure, he's been through his Via Dolorosa in prison, and I'm perfectly willing to believe that he's seen the error of his ways and so forth, and that stands to his credit. But let's be honest, Khodorkovsky is a symbol for those who are looking for symbols, those who are already opposed to the current regime and want to look for victims of Putin and the Putinist thing. And in any case, a symbol like him is not going to bring down the regime. Lech Walesa was out there agitating in a way that the Russian Soviet dissidents were inside prisons being great moral figures, but not actually directly able to bring down the regime. So, I mean, I think actually in prison, someone is almost invariably less significant in terms of domestic politics. But The one point I would make is that whereas, whatever the impact on Russians, one has to also think in this day and age about the impact on the outside world. Again, Khodorkovsky is in many ways especially significant in the outside world as a symbol of the ills of Putinism, precisely the people who've forgotten or don't care about what he did when he was making his money in the 1990s. Well, likewise, Navalny in prison becomes a very powerful symbol of the sort of the, quote, neo-Soviet sort of Putin regime and such. Like, you know, one can see the headlines already. And, you know, you could ask Magnitsky, were he still alive, just how important a symbol can be in terms of mobilizing sort of governments. So in that respect, I think, you know, again, if we come back to it, really the Kremlin would have to decide what is most important to it. Navalny in prison has an international cost, but less of a domestic cost.
But a domestic cost, nonetheless.
Yeah, some. I think entirely bearable one. Mm. Again, he just simply becomes another symbol for those who are looking for symbols.
In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and shift the focus a bit and look at a paradox facing the opposition, one we've alluded to in the first half of the podcast. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RVRL. In the studio with me in Prague is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University and expert in Russia Security Services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. And also with me in the studio in Prague is special guest and veteran Kremlin watcher David Satter, a longtime Moscow correspondent, a fellow at the Johns Hopkins School of International Studies, and author of numerous books on Russia, including my favorite, Darkness at Dawn, The Rise of the Russian Criminal State. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Борец с «Единой России» мэр Ярославля.
Громкий коррупционный скандал сотряс Ярославль.
Вымогали у директора коммерческого общества взятку в размере 14
миллионов. Возбуждено уголовное дело.
Арестовать мэра Евгения Урлашова.
Удар по гражданским свободам и свободам каждого жителя России.
Last April, Yevgeny Urlashov was a conquering hero when he took 70% of the vote and defeated a Kremlin-backed candidate to become mayor of Yaroslavl. Last week, he was arrested and charged with bribe-taking. It remains unclear whether the charges against Urlashov have any merit, and it's tempting to dismiss them as the latest instance of Kremlin revenge against a political foe. The authorities certainly don't deserve the benefit of the doubt there. But as the daily Nezavisimaya Gazeta noted in an editorial this week, the Urlashov case also illustrates a paradox the opposition faces in the rare instances when they win power. How do you govern effectively and honestly in a system that is corrupt to the core? Mark, I want to read the money graphs from that editorial, if you'll bear with me as I wade through them, and ask you to respond. So here goes. Quote, "The opposition believes that the replacement of a dishonest and thieving ruling elite with one that is honest and unsullied will make it possible to disentangle the mechanism of social life and administration, which is normal and capable of functioning properly. But there is reason to doubt that such a normal net mechanism exists in Russia at all. The administrative matrix is formed more by unwritten practices. Corruption here is one means of getting the job done. And any politician, including an opposition politician, who has received a mandate for administration has to fit into this system one way or another. When a politician integrates himself into this system, a dossier begins to be built on him that could potentially discredit him. It is published at the necessary moment. He governed according to unwritten norms, but he will be judged according to written ones." This seems to get to the heart of the matter, does it not? I mean, we discussed this, came up again and again, David, in your comments in the first part. Mark, let's go to you first. If this is the case, is Russia unreformable?
It's ironic, really, that having spent the first half talking about how Navalny could become mayor of Moscow, we really now have to turn to the fact that being mayor is an awful job in Russia.
What if Navalny wins? It might be the worst thing that ever happens to him.
Yeah, I mean, again, just using the position of mayor as just simply, you know, one way of looking at the problem. If you're the mayor of a city, and okay, Moscow is different as in every other aspect, but you are faced with a variety of demands. You have a constituency that expects you to change things. In practice, though, most of your budget is determined by the governor, who has absolutely no problem with just basically starving you of funds if, and particularly as in this case, you have a political problem. If you do decide that you want to fight corruption, okay, you can try and bring in sort of, you know, ways of controlling the sort of contracting and procurement process. But, for example, you don't control the local police. You don't control the local investigative authorities and so forth. So actually, well, how are you going to go after the corrupt people? You know, for all kinds of reasons, actually, you are not a governor of a city or manager of a city. You are actually there to be the system's representative, to be the system's manager in their name. So in this respect, I mean, it does create the question, well, where do you start? Where can you actually start reforming these problems? And the problem is actually that it's a lovely idea, and I must admit I was enthused at the time, to think that one could begin to work on this problem from the grassroots.
We did a whole podcast on this.
Exactly. And it was lovely and it was sweet, and we were wrong.
Yeah, it wouldn't be the first time. It won't be the last.
We thought that Yaroslavl could be the way of the
Yaroslavl
future.
Precedent was the headline of my blog on this.
Absolutely. But, you know, but we've seen since then, 90% of non-United Russia mayors have been forced out of office, largely through corruption and similar investigations.
Right.
And the other 10% are essentially hobbled or useless, or else they have just been bought over. Clearly from the bottom doesn't work. But as we've seen in previous reform attempts, actually even reform from the top is hardly easy.
Right. So, I mean, this goes to some of the things you were talking about in the first half in the discussion of Navalny. I mean, is the system unreformable if this is the case? Because if you get in power, never mind mayor, governor, president for that matter, you still have this system that is, corruption is not a bug in the system. It's a feature. Right, it's a phrase I've used countless times because it's so apt. Where do you begin? Is this unreformable in this situation?
Well, I don't think that Russia is unreformable, but it has to change at a fundamental moral level. It can't remain the same, basically immoral and a brutal country that it is, and expect that on that base they're going to create an honest civil service, an efficient bureaucracy, fair courts, and a functioning system. So, that won't happen. I mean, this is the source really of my unease about Navalny,
which I think is more an unease about Russia. It's not so much about Navalny.
Well, I think that what Russia needs is more or less clear to people who begin to think about it, which is that it needs a new moral beginning. It needs a complete reckoning with its history. It needs a reexamination of its psychology. It needs the willingness to face past crimes. It needs all of these things. It, of course, needs vigorous anti-corruption measures, but they're not going to be effective until people come face to face with what the fundamental problem is in the society, which is, you know, the lack of regard for human life, the lack of regard for the worth of the individual. These are things that actually – these are issues that actually can be raised. And they need to be raised if there's going to be change, a positive change. I mean, change is always possible, but the question is it going to be positive change? And an exclusive focus on corruption without addressing these deeper issues threatens to possibly undermine the present system without creating the conditions for something better to take its place.
Mark?
Yes, I mean, anti-corruption could just as easily be, let's face it, the clarion call for an ultra-nationalist authoritarian regime.
Of course it could.
Let's sweep out all these parasites, with firing squads and, you know, tough auditing and so forth. I don't think anyone would regard that as being a great step forward for Russia. It's interesting, though. I mean, how does a country do this?
I mean, in many cases, when
countries have done this, it's because they've lost wars.
Yes,
often
Germany did it after the Second World War. That's the most famous.
I hesitate to say that Russia's tragedy was that it lost the Cold War without really noticing it, but certainly it was never forced to come to terms with that. And you know, it sounds incredibly arrogant to sort of to say, "Oh, Russia should come to terms with its evil and corrupt past." But nonetheless, I mean, I agree that there has to be some sort of substantial
catharsis.
Catharsis, But again, but you know, catharsis can be good or bad. Again, it's reorientation of its whole moral compass. Now, barring some catastrophic collapse and then reconstitution, which I don't think anyone would want to wish on Russia, you know, when we come to, well, what can be done? I think the thing is, what is clear is that exactly one has to address the elements of the system that are self-replicating. And this is, again, where corruption comes in. You say it's a feature rather than a bug. Well, precisely because corruption is how Russia is run. That's how you bind elites together. That's how you rise within the elite.
That's how you control the elite.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, it's obviously in no one's interest in the Kremlin at the moment to do anything substantially about it. Because to do so, they'd have to repudiate a structure which, you know, let's face it, predates independent Russia. I mean, it's how the Soviet Union operated. Yeah. And one could say, in some ways, the same of Tsarism. But nonetheless, it will ultimately take that kind of a systemic approach from the top. The people at the bottom can demand change of national leaderships, but they can't. I think it's, you know, and this is, in some ways, this is what, going back to Urlashov, I think it's clear, they can't expect that the actual change can happen from the bottom.
Mm. One thing, and this is from the bottom, I mean, one thing that right now does give me hope and actually makes me think maybe, just maybe, this time will be different, and that is the generational change we're seeing right now. The very first generation that was not born, the first generation born after the collapse of the Soviet Union, is now coming of age. And they are different. They are different. And they have different demands. And I think we're seeing this. When you had the Moscow winter, or the Moscow spring, or whatever you call what happened in December, January 2011 and afterwards, it was striking that this generation was a bit different than previous generations, a bit more savvy, a bit more cosmopolitan, a bit more in touch with the rest of the world. And you have to wonder if that's not going to have an effect over the long term. No, David?
I don't know. I would like to think it will have an effect. After all, we do see, you know, the growth of a middle class. We do see people who are better informed.
For the first time in Russia's history.
Yeah, and Russia, you know, I've been coming to Russia since, I hate to admit it, since 1969 when I was a graduate student. And I always thought of Russia as a very poor country. But for the first time under Putin, largely as a result of the commodities boom in the 2000s, I saw signs of prosperity and middle-class life.
Yeah.
And not just in Moscow and St. Petersburg either.
It's wider.
But will that have an effect? Russia is already too well-educated and too wealthy for the kind of government that it has. Will it have an effect without a change in mentality? And
don't these things create changes in mentality? And another thing I would add,
they may create the conditions under which a change of mentality is possible. But what will make it, what will lead to a genuine change in mentality is the emergence of those moral forces in society that are ready to work for it.
And see, and going back to Navalny, I see Navalny as a product of these changes you were just describing. He's much this kind of middle-class style politician that appeals to that constituency, which is growing, let's face it.
Yes, but there's a negative side to these developments as well. I mean, the new internet generation, the dependence on gadgets to which people are all too easily subordinated, the limiting of horizons that result as people are in a position to say more and more about less and less. All of this, the disappearance of the deeper ideological issues which characterized the Cold War, all of that creates the possibility that the new generation, for all of its talent, its exposure to the world, for all of its ambition and desire to create a new way of life, will not have the mental and moral wherewithal to do so. Mm. And also there's another factor, which is that the prosperity in Russia, the private economy, was based to a great degree on theft. And the lessons have been learned. Many people witnessed how in the 90s it was the most unscrupulous, the most dishonest, and the most brutal who managed to scrape together the biggest fortunes, and they know that that process continues. Do they have the wherewithal to resist those tendencies? That's the question. Well, and to judge them and understand that the danger that they represent to the national life.
I think I'm going to give it an optimistic yes, conditional and very optimistic yes, because I'm an optimist by nature, because I think this new generation is seeing things that you can make a living by with an internet startup. You can do it. I mean, it's hard. It's not easy. It's a lot harder than it would be to do in, you know, Canada, but it's doable. I mean, I'm reminded of a story we did a few years back on the importance of social media in the countries we cover here at RFERL, and a Russian gave, I thought, the best quote in, and he said, you know, and for you guys, these gadgets and YouTubes are things to watch. These gadgets and YouTube are things to watch cat videos on that you laugh at. For us, it's a thing we can record the abuses of police officers on and show the country what's going on and create a movement. And so I think the gadget, the fetishism of gadgets, is a very different thing. Russians love their gadgets for the same reasons we love ours too, but they do take on this entirely different meaning.
They have that potential, but they also have the potential of helping people to forget what's going on around them. A person who's submerged in the virtual world has really experiences the danger of a very limited perspective. Mm. And a very, very narrowed intellectual horizons.
I put it another way, actually, because I think one could say that, you know, maybe it's trading depth for breadth. But the point is, these virtual worlds actually create communities which are far, far broader than in the old model, the sort of your friends who sit around the kitchen table and talk about how bad things are. Now, I mean, again, I think that the new generation of Russians are very much citizens of the world. They see what, I mean, in part because they travel, they flock to Prague to come and drink. But they, you know, they travel, a lot of them speak foreign languages and look at foreign media, or else they look at foreign media in Russian, or they just use the magic of Google Translate to try and sort of get sort of bizarre sort of
bizarre translations with bad grammar.
Precisely, but nonetheless, the point is that they are able to connect, and I think that they are, from that, able to draw lessons. I remember once sort of someone saying, you know, today's Russians, the great virtue is that they're less Russian, which I think is a little unfair. I think
I
mean, it's actually that what being Russian means is now at a process of redefinition, which again doesn't mean that it's a done deal and they're going to change in sort of tomorrow or in exactly the direction that we might expect. But nonetheless, there is change. And I mean, again, I'll sort of go back to my own comfort zone. If I think of talking to cops, again, it's often my sort of benchmark. Because in some ways, I think this is the danger. If one looks at, you know, internet startup people and so forth, they are by definition people who've already kind of opted into a new order. 10 years ago, basically, and I'm slightly caricaturing, but only slightly, and the good and honest cop who I talked to in Russia is the one who basically, once he realised that someone was really bad but was too well connected to actually bring to the courts, the honest cop would plant evidence to make sure that they got the bad guy in prison. Mm. The honest cop now, and it's interesting in conversations, what they're actually trying to do is working out how within the law. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, they understand they operate within a very, very flawed system. And sometimes they're not going to be bothered to actually fight it, and sometimes they're going to just give up and just go and get drunk with their friends or go home to their families or whatever. But the point is, they are now looking not so much at just simply, well, how can I essentially be corrupt, but corrupt in the name of the angels, but instead they're now aware of the weaknesses of their system and trying to work out, well, how can I make the system work, which is at least one step closer to thinking, how can I ensure that we have a system that does work?
Right. And I think, again, to bring ourselves full circle as we wrap up here, I think this whole what's going on with Navalny, who is exemplary, born in 76, the man's 37 years old, came of age, you know, was coming of age right after the Soviet collapse. We have the exemplar of this generation, and how he does and what he does in a lot of ways, I think, is going to be a barometer of Russia one way or the other. And that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague has been my co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the excellent blog In Moscow's Shadows. And also with me in the studio in Prague has been special guest and longtime Kremlin watcher David Satter, a a fellow at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and author of numerous books on Russia. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
It's been fun.
Thank you.
I would also like to thank our producer, Pavel Balak, who's filling in for Tanya Koncheva, who is on a beach somewhere in Croatia enjoying a much-deserved vacation from me. I'd also like to thank my indispensable colleague Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast in iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper Noise MC.